I'm Michael, and welcome to Beyond the Screenplay, the podcast where each week we do a conversational deep dive analysis into a film. Today, we are talking about What Lies Beneath, the 2000 film by directed by Robert Zemeckis, screenplay by Clark Gregg, also known as Agent Phil Coulson. I'm joined today by the Beyond the Screenplay team, Trisha Arand.
Hello, everyone.
Ryan Bittner.
Hello, hello.
And Alex Calleros.
Hi.
So before we dive into this masterpiece, the question that we have for Spotify listeners and people watching on YouTube is, what's your favorite ghost story? Let us know in the comments below. I know it's all going to be What Lies Beneath, but let's do this exercise anyway. Okay, so we've talked about this movie a lot over the past several episodes because it's one of those movies that I loved and Alex also loved and that we shared a strange bond over this 2000 film.
Influenced us both like weirdly to like way more than it should have as directors.
Right. Very strongly influenced by this.
That's why you guys shot that one movie entirely through a side view mirror, right?
Exactly. I did like the first horror like films that I've made were like just me trying to recreate this, like back in like, you know, college and high school. Just like, I gotta make What Lies Beneath. And it's so inspired by this masterpiece.
I think I made a film in high school that was called like What Lies Below. I changed one word and right. I just used the soundtrack and everything.
I made one that was What Lies on the Floor, and it was about a ghost cat that was fat and laid on the floor. But there was also a serious one. Anyway.
This is all very adorable.
Forget about talking about this movie. We just need to dive into all this right now.
Why this movie? Why did it capture our young minds?
Yeah.
Let's get into it.
So, so we've already clearly given an impression of, you know, when we saw it. I don't think I saw it in theaters, but my parents and I, for a brief period in like middle school, high school, when I was old enough to watch cool movies, but like still young enough to not have like friends and things to do on Saturday nights, we would do Saturday night movie nights. And I'm pretty sure this was one of them. And I remember like sitting down with the popcorn and watching it and just being like, oh my God, this is amazing. I saw it, I don't think when it came out, but shortly after, and then watched it over and over again. Alex, I assume the case is similar for you. Did you see it in theaters? Do you know?
I don't think I saw it in theaters, but I think I did see it. You know, I had the Blockbuster experience. I rented it and fell in love. I remember seeing this movie and I think, you know, I was at that impressionable young, like, you know, 13-year-old range where the idea, like a movie that has a twist like this was still like incredibly mind-blowing in how the movie could kind of seem to end, but then, oh my God, no, it's like just getting started, this third act. And then all the Hitchcock of the film, it was almost like I was introduced to Hitchcock before I saw a lot of Hitchcock. Like I may have seen like Psycho, but this movie has so many homages to that Hitchcock kind of paranoid thriller, you know, Rear Window, Psycho. There's so much in here. And so in a strange way, it was like I got introduced to those genre tropes that Hitchcock originated through, like the homage to Hitchcock movie, which is interesting, but definitely there is a lineage there of that kind of Hitchcock sensibility that I really gravitated towards and I got so into. And I think there's also something strangely, you know, my parents have a much happier marriage than these two people, but like my dad's a professor and he's like always working on his laptop, and my mom kind of, you know, can be a busybody sometimes and trying to keep herself busy. And so there's a weird also parallel of like these kind of seem like my parents, and like strange parallels there that maybe kind of resonated. So anyway, all of that added up to just, yeah, for some reason this movie really struck a chord with me. And I think because it has a lot of clever filmmakery, you know, Robert Zemeckis type things in it, interesting use of visual effects, you know, lots of oners. I think I just was really into all of that at that age and just got excited to watch it and rewatch it and notice all these filmmaking techniques throughout the movie.
Yeah. 100% the same. Okay, so for the non-us people, so Trisha, you watched this during your Harrison Ford-a-thon. Is that accurate?
Yes, I used this. This is the finale. What was the finale of my Harrison Ford-a-thon?
The grand finale.
It was. So I am a big Zemeckis fan, actually. I mean, who wouldn't be? Back to the Future, some of the greatest films pretty much ever. And then he's done a bunch of others that I really, really like. So like Castaway is another one that I love. Contact, I adore. Like he's a really fascinating filmmaker. And so I had a compilation CD of Silvestri scores because Silvestri has done a bunch of Zemeckis films, scored quite a few of them. And so I had this compilation CD and I would just listen to it from start to finish. And it starts off with Romancing the Stone, which is great. And it goes all the way through Castaway, which was right after this one. And so, you know, I think it had like 10 tracks on it. It's got like 10 movies. And so the What Lies Beneath score, like the main titles, I guess, of What Lies Beneath were like the second to last track on this CD that I had. And I'd seen all the others. Like Death Becomes Her is also another really interesting Zemeckis film.
Yeah, I watched that last October and it
holds up. If you haven't seen Death Becomes Her, definitely check that out. Like Meryl Streep at the like greatest.
Yeah.
anyway, but I'd seen like every other single like Zemeckis Silvestri collab because of that CD. And I had avoided this one because I was so sure it was going to terrify me. And watched it at the end of my Harrison Ford marathon. And it was a very unpleasant experience because it did scare me because there are a ton of jump scares in this movie. Mm-hmm. And they're like definitely all executed in the like cheapest, jump scariest way possible. Yep. Like half the time it's just something dumb that's like there. She's gonna run up to the fence and be like, someone's looking right back on the other side through the fence. And like, yeah, the dog is there so many times. It's just the dog. Anyway, so it did really scare me the first time I watched it, but then I rewatched it in advance of this podcast, knowing where everything is and like what happens and knowing the whole thing. And it was just such a fun movie to rewatch and appreciate on so many levels. It's also, how can I put this politely? Perhaps not the landmark film that it has established itself in your brains to be.
Revisiting it.
I think there are a lot of lessons we can extract from here, both do's and don'ts. And so I'm excited to get into the whole thing and unpack it all with you guys.
Excellent. Yeah. Awesome. Okay. And so, Brian, had you seen it before we did this to you?
Oh, yeah. I saw it back, 20 years ago when it came out. And the impression it made on me was not strong one way or the other.
Yep. I feel like that's a lot talk of about people's the movie. Experience.
Yeah. I thought it was fine. Like, I had no, again, I enjoyed it for what it was and then never really thought about it much in 20 years. But I really did have a blast rewatching it. It's like, I was looking it up and I'm like, oh yeah, it's 47% Rotten Tomatoes. Just like bad reviews. And I'm like, yeah, because I don't care. This is not a movie that I need to be good. It's just a blast to watch. And I had a really good time revisiting it. So thank you.
Excellent. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, so like you said, Trisha, let's dive into it. I think the Robert Zemeckis-ness of it is, I think, one of the things that I still really enjoy about it. And I mentioned this in one of our recent episodes. There was this period of time around, you know, the turn of the century where we were realizing that visual effects could do things. And so much of the, you know, mission statement behind this movie, as you were saying, Alex, was let's do things that Hitchcock would have done if he had digital technology. And some of them are more successful than others, but I find all of them really interesting. So like the one that blew my mind is toward the end of the film when Michelle Pfeiffer, she's on the ground, she's been paralyzed by the magic paralyzing
substance
that he's
just
been working
on. Set up in a very precise way earlier moment of exposition. Can it work on all mammals? Oh, yes.
Definitely. I thought of you, Trisha, as like, hang a lantern. That's what it looks like when you hang a lantern on a thing.
Very big time. Cool. Let's circle back to the exposition. I have lots of thoughts on the exposition in this movie.
Yeah. But anyway, so she's there and, you know, her husband then comes and leans over and says the thing and the camera moves forward like along the floor and then goes beneath the floor and you're looking at her from beneath the floor. And it's just like, wait, what? Like, how could you possibly do that? This is the year 2000. I don't understand. Or then later when she's running out of the house, she runs out, gets into the car. The camera starts from a wide shot outside of the car, moves then inside of the car and then down below the steering wheel. And so, you know, in both of those situations, it's, you know, for the car, they had to just kind of create a little rig for her to sit in. And then the car is CG and disappears. And same thing with, you know, they had to build the set such that you could have a glass floor and then add a CG wooden floor there so the camera can go underneath the glass just in time. So there's all these like tools being used in this way kind of for the first time. And it does feel a little bit like it does make me, I don't know, the mission statement of what would Hitchcock have done if he had those tools. I get a little bit of that, you know, wonder or the, oh yeah, like there are these new possibilities and this might be what, you know, who knows what he would have done, but it's cool to see a movie that just goes for it and comes up with these crazy shots that's playing in this kind of melodrama horror place. And it feels right for this kind of story.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's funny because it's this cross section of, you've got Shyamalan just showing up and like, is he the new Hitchcock? No. And then you have like these, The Ring and The Others, which are these like, oh, it's kind of a ghost drama. It's like, it's sort of, you know, this movie is kind of a thriller first and a horror movie second, right? And in the same way, The Others is kind of a drama first and a horror movie second. And then you have the CG stuff you're talking about, like what Fincher was doing in Fight Club and Panic Room, which are on either side of this movie. And a lot of people were doing, you know, which then a few years later, we get Children of Men where Cuarón's like, wait, this is how you actually do this stuff.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But yeah, this movie is kind of the perfect venue for that weird CG stuff. Cause I feel like in a better movie, you would be kind of annoyed by it. It would feel cheap. But in this movie, it's like, yeah, why not go beneath the floor? Let's do it.
Right.
There's overall just a fun B movie quality about what lies beneath. And part of it, I think, may have come from the fact that it was shot during hiatus for Castaway. It was actually shot while they were waiting for Tom Hanks to lose weight. And so I think there's probably kind of a freedom that comes where it's like, I'm just going to squeeze a movie in here and just and like have a ball. And I'm going to do all these crazy CG Hitchcock shots that I've always dreamed of. And you know, why the hell not? And that's part of what I think is still really charming about this film is that it does have that B movie freedom to not try to be, it's not going for an Oscar. It's just having fun.
Well, and one of the things I really like about Zemeckis, especially in the 80s and 90s, is the performances that he gets out of people. And the performances from Harrison Ford and Michelle Pfeiffer are really interesting and cool and fun here. Like, this is not your normal Harrison Ford kind of a role. And, you know, I talked about how Harrison Ford, like, in his action roles, often is doing very little on his face. And actually, he kind of gets big and, like, kind of out there and really aggressive in his acting, where he's normally, you know, more like held back, I think, in this movie. And, you know, it's pretty clear to me that like Michelle Pfeiffer too is like just working as hard as she possibly can to sell all of this. Yeah. And in the hands of lesser actors, it doesn't work at all, right? Like, I think that they're part of the reason that it's you know, kind of like you're saying, it's a melodrama, but it's compelling in so many ways. Like, Michelle Pfeiffer has to do that insane scene where she's like possessed by the ghost. And she's like seducing him. And I'm just like, this is a bad scene in any other movie. And in this movie, it's not a great one, but Michelle Pfeiffer is
but it rocks.
But like, but I am loving it while it's happening. Yeah.
No, of course. Yeah. It's almost, yeah, like this campy B movie thing, but like they've got enough gravity to their performances. And Zemeckis was a master of tone, you know, in that way. Like, again, watch Death Becomes Her. If you want to know what like a really like tone tightrope is, and Zemeckis can really walk it, there's always this like sort of layer of like just splashy moviness underneath of everything. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Back to the Future is sort of like the most distilled in terms of like, this is just a splashy movie and it's just movie all the time. And the rest of his other movies, though, do more blending of different genre things. And he's always able to get these great performances, especially in the 80s and 90s. I admit to having missed a few of his more recent films in the 21st century, the ones that are
animated.
Just mocap. Yeah. the entire movies. But yeah, especially in the 80s and 90s, he gets some great performances out of his leading folk. And these are two really good ones.
Yeah. Death Becomes Her is funny because it knows it's a comedy. That's never not trying to be a comedy, but it's Meryl Streep and Goldie Hawn and Bruce mm-hmm. Willis and Isabella Rossellini. So it's like actors who can give you a performance that doesn't feel like the actors know they're in a comedy, which is exactly the always the funniest, you know, performance. Exactly. But What Lies Beneath is this weird middle ground where it's like you kind of need to handle it like a real serious movie, and you kind of need your actors to really be giving the serious performances, which then buys you some amount of silliness, maybe not quite this much, but it buys you some. And Michelle Pfeiffer, I think, was one of the first, I would say Annette Bening was one of the first like female actors where I was like, oh, you're my favorite. I've actually seen you in enough stuff and you're like awesome all the time, which weirdly in the, like back then I was just like, oh, all my favorite actors happen to be men. And now I don't think any of them are, like, I think like if I can like my top 10 actors, like none of them are men, nothing against them, but just like weirdly it like switched to where I'm like Olivia Colman and, you know, all these people. And back then it was like all the Johnny Depp and Brad Pitt and Michelle Pfeiffer. I was like, yes, you, I see you.
Yeah.
Well, she's so striking, and it's interesting how this movie draws attention to her eyes because of that,
of course,
the eye change in that one scene. But, you know, her normal eyes are so interesting, and they have that kind of almost like gray faded quality to them that gives her this like really just captivating presence. And so you can really, you know, this movie is just mostly her like walking around a house.
Yeah,
but
yeah. Truly.
but it's like interesting enough to watch her do that, which is once again, it's a lot of responsibility to put on an actress to say, hey, we're gonna have you just walking around, the doors are gonna open and a picture's gonna fall over and we're just gonna look at your face during all that. And it's got to be interesting.
Well, to your point, Alex, I was thinking about, you know, this seems like a really simple world for a story, but it's rendered with such clarity, right? Where it's like the world of the story is really contained, but in sort of a Hitchcockian way, you have to go into every single corner of this house. You have to go into every single, like, relationship within the, you know, so there's the supporting cast of characters and you kind of have to dive into each one of those relationships and like the university and the sort of like small New England townness of it all and the lake that's right there. Because the world of the story is so small, it has to be just, yeah, really sharp, and we need to understand its boundaries sort of and rules really clearly. And that also is what gives Michelle Pfeiffer's character I want to say dimensionality, but I guess what I really mean is, I don't know, like sort of the depth of her, we sort of understand how she feels because of how contained the world is around her in the way that a lot of really great Hitchcock movies do. And so, you know, watching her walk around in the house, especially at the beginning, first of all, she's just like, you know, has there ever been somebody to play a bitch better than Michelle Pfeiffer? Like, she's just like the bitchiest all the time, sort of right beneath the surface. And so, you know, for like a New England, rich New England housewife, she's like, there's nobody better with a better look than Michelle Pfeiffer, and her composure and everything. She just looks like, she just looks expensive and well-kept all the time. it's fantastic. I just saw Scarface recently. I talked about it on the podcast, and that's like early Michelle Pfeiffer, but like expensive and well-kept and a total bitch. She's just the best.
Is she a total bitch in this movie? She seems
but like, I guess what I just mean is like, you know, sort of like a spoiled rich woman right. kind of thing. Yeah,
I mean, like that enormous house on that lake, and yeah, she's so, you know, pristine and perfect right. at all times.
And yeah. the costume design is impeccable too, where she's always just like in her blouses and slacks and whatever, yeah. and her hair is just kind of
until she's in her red dress.
But yeah, but we feel the desperation from her because we understand the world really clearly, and the movie does a really good job of bounding it. And she's always cutting herself on roses. You know, it's just it all fits into this really great package of world building and the central character. They feel intimately connected to each other.
Right.
This woman exists in this world. This world exists as an extension of this character. And those things are just intimately intertwined and just completely clear the minute we see them on screen.
Totally. Plus, this movie does an interesting thing where we're always in her POV,
which
raises the question, did that picture actually fall? Did she actually see that thing that she saw, you know? And the movie never really calls that into question too much, but it is playing a little bit with like, oh, you're feeling stress since the accident, and you know, you da da da. So it kind of, by keeping it in her POV, it always is raising that question of like, oh, is this an unreliable narrator story, or is this a story about somebody who actually is seeing these things? And that sort of keeps that mystery open a little bit. Again, which involves a lot of her just in a house by herself walking around.
Yeah.
Yeah. In an interesting way, there's a lot of, you know, Hitchcock character psychology in this movie where it's about, it's like Empty Nest, the movie. You know, if you're this, you know, lead character that kind of has an underlying anxiety, or there's something fishy with your marriage that has kind of been put off dealing with because you're focusing on your child. The child is gone now, and now there's the anxiety is rising to the surface. And what do you do with yourself now that all you're left with is your husband, who's kind of maybe not a good guy actually, and has these flare-ups of anger that are kind of scary at moments. And so I think there's just a lot of like dealing with this suburban anxiety, this empty nest anxiety, and the first half of the movie, before kind of ghost stuff is all but confirmed, there is that open question of,
right,
is this a woman just kind of driving herself mad because of the empty nest marriage falling apart, maybe stuff going on?
Yeah. And I like that it's that big red herring with the neighbors too.
Right.
Like there's fully half the movie basically where you're sure that she is on to like a Rear Window kind of murder thing.
This is the funny thing though, is yes, obviously Rear Window so much, but between Rear Window and this movie was The Burbs, the brilliant Tom Hanks star of Castaway movie, where he sees his neighbors, like, you know, pulling a garbage bag out to the trash, and like, why is he digging a hole in the middle of the night? And the 1994 episode of The Simpsons, Bart of Darkness, which is very much inspired by Rear Window, but again, it's two suburban houses next to each other. Bart is watching, he breaks his leg and he has a telescope. He's watching Flanders, and Flanders like yells about something and he says, oh no, I'm a murderer. And then Bart sees him dragging a bag out and all this kind of stuff. So now I'm watching What Lies Beneath going, well, yeah, you're doing a Rear Window thing, but you also seem to be referencing these two comedies from like the early 90s. And that's a weird kind of thing. So it's like, there's this whole litany of Rear Window, but
sure,
suburban neighborhood movies in this decade for some reason,
which I guess makes sense for the 90s. You know, it's
sure
we're in the like peak suburbia at that moment, so
right,
we're just transplanting everything there.
And I feel like that's why it's good to watch this when you're 13 or 14 and haven't seen other movies.
Right. So exactly.
Fresh and new. But yeah, I was struck by how domestic of a movie it was while still being horror. And I was thinking about, you know, The Ring, and The Ring is, you know, focused on a family and like Rachel and the son. And so it's kind of, you know, in a similar ballpark of, you know, like we talked about like a drama horror thing, but this is like super domestic, like you're saying, Alex, the like empty nest syndrome. And it was cool. I'd forgotten how many twists there were and how many red herrings there were. So yeah, there's the neighbor, but there's also, for a while, you think that maybe, you know, you're worried about Norman, but then he seems to be on her side and he has that moment where like, yes, I believe you. And so there's a moment where it's like, oh, maybe he's like okay too. When they're together, they're gonna fight the ghost. They're like all these little things that are fun that maybe don't make any sense, but like provide a lot of really cool twists and turns. The biggest question for me is like she has amnesia kind of about like a horrific accident that she was in and seeing her husband cheating her, but she just completely forgot about it.
Trisha has thoughts.
Trisha's face.
Okay. The backstory of this movie is insane. It is way too complicated. It is an example of how not to do backstory ever. Like, it's just so hard to parse and follow. And like, it ends up being somewhat of consequence, but it's also even more complicated than it really needs to be. So, okay. Thing number one is, if you have a character that was in some kind of accident where they were injured and they have lasting damage, physical, psychological, I don't care. Put a scar on their face. You have to do something. You have to like put their arm in a sling. You have to put a bandage on their head. You have to like put a surgical scar somewhere visible where I can see it, where I'm constantly reminded, oh yeah, that person was in an accident and that is currently still affecting them. You cannot show a picture in a photo album with like a damaged car and then just like a handwritten note of a year. But I don't even know what year this movie is supposed to be taking place. Right. I don't know how long ago it was. Like, wow.
Yeah, that photo book scene, watching it again, I was like, they're leaning on this one, like flipping through a photo book to do work about so many different like plot yes. threads. Mm-hmm. Like yes. this stuff about her music, about her like previous marriage.
Her and when first
which had a baby, like, and also here's a car wreck, and also the, like here's
Norman's father.
Getting, yeah. yeah, Norman's dad is dead too, by the way.
Right.
Okay. Yeah. Again, it's more complicated than it needs to be, right? So, like, in my opinion, the only backstory that we actually need for this movie, if you want to keep everything else in the plot the same, is that she was in a car accident and had a head injury and doesn't remember some things. The rest of it. First husband, get him out of here. He's useless. That's like, just have her married to Norman the whole time. It's way too complicated that he's not Caitlin's actual father. There's no reason for him not to be Caitlin's actual father, I guess, except it's like,
it makes him more threatening at the end in some
sure.
ways. You know, like, that really yeah. creepy line he says to her in
he's
the
like,
bathtub.
He's like, gonna get close to Caitlin yeah. Yeah, after she
and
dies.
And it maybe like buys you a little bit of like, you know,
would he be so evil
him.
If he was really yeah
right, like, you know, he has that monologue of like I swooped in and saved you and blah blah blah. There's like a little bit of like, oh okay,
so complicated. Norman's father, get him out of here. He doesn't belong in this story at all. Like, her music, no. she was never a musician, stop it. Like, all of this stuff is so complicated and hard for us to keep track of, and so little of it ends up being of consequence in any way.
Right.
And the problem, one of the problems that it causes is that A, we don't know what's important in the backstory and what's not. So we spend a lot of unnecessary time in our brains trying to sort out the timeline and figure out the details, which is a distraction from the main plot, which is what we need to be following. But another big problem with it is that it forces you into the clunkiest kinds of exposition yeah. possible, which is what I was saying about like put a scar on her forehead or something. Where instead of having her best friend go, well, you wrapped your car around a telephone pole going 80 miles an hour. Anyway, your daughter just left for college. You're extremely close to her, remember?
Like, Gabe, you look at my car. Da, 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 da. Let's get some drinks. Just the weirdest character.
I love that character.
That scene is the most unforgivable one in the movie, though. When she comes over and she's like, by the way, I told my psychic about you. And she's like, you told your psychic about me. And she's like, she gave me this mushroom tea for you. And it's, there's so much about that scene with the exposition. It's so clunky, but you have to do that when you tie unnecessary knots in your backstory. And so, like, this is a great example of some things need to be streamlined here. And you probably need to hang a lantern a lot earlier on the fact that she can't remember some things. And also, I kept right. expecting the reveal that he's the one who caused the accident, right? Like, surely she found out something and that's why she was in an accident. But the movie doesn't like about the affair, right? And that's like why she wrapped her car around a telephone pole. But I feel like the movie never really
I think that's implied. She says like I saw you there and then I drove the car.
But it is once. This weird thing where they like they imply it and they walk right up to like saying that officially, but then never do quite. So there is a little weird hanging like I'm pretty sure that's what happened, but the movie didn't like confirm that and the timeline of when all
I would say in Clark Gregg's defense, lovely Clark Gregg, I think there's good intention behind the overly convoluted backstory. Like I do think it's an interesting character trait for Harrison Ford's character, who has a lot of ego, who really cares about his image and his work, to be in the shadow of his father, who everybody knows and nobody knows him. I think it's interesting that part of what's, you know, beneath the surface, under the surface of their marriage is this kind of, you know, problem. There's that like resentment that can stew over time where it's like, I was on a path and then I met you and I went on a different path and it worked for you, but maybe now I regret that path. And so all these elements, I understand why they're there and they make the characters interesting, but I do agree that the movie seems to point to all of them equally as all being like equally relevant and
to the mystery.
As you're trying to solve this mystery, it gets really confusing. It's like, oh, is the music a thing? Like, is that going to come back?
And
it's like, no, like she plays the cello in the scene because she wants to take it up again, but that's about it. So yeah, I think it in a movie where you as the audience are trying to solve a mystery, having this many random backstory things does not help. Even if they're well-intentioned.
Yeah, like I think they're there to give characters motivation, which is good. But yeah, as you were saying, they need to be streamlined or built into things in a more organic way and given the proper weight.
Yeah, or weighted correctly in order of importance, which to me, the memory loss is number one important thing and needs to be front-loaded and just given to us visually within the first instant of seeing her. That would be very helpful.
Because otherwise it feels cheap where it's like
out of
nowhere we've invented this new mechanic.
I feel like there are, I want to talk about the bathtub scene at some point, because like that's, you know, where this all leads to. And but part of it that I think was fun watching it back then, and that I think they talk about even in like the behind the scenes making ofs, was that Harrison Ford had kind of never played a bad guy before, and like never been like the evil one. And at that point had never died on screen, I think. So it was like, there was a lot of meta fun of like, we're casting Harrison Ford because of course he's going to be like the loving husband that everyone roots for, but he gets to play a bad guy. And it was weird. I feel like I like him through most of the movie, but once he goes into full evil, I'm monologuing about my plan and like how hard it was to strangle the life out of that girl, it stops working for me. And I was wondering if you guys had that also, because I agree with what you were saying earlier, Trisha, where I think a lot of his performance in this movie is really great and feels like one of the better Harrison Ford performances, and you can see there's a lot going on in there, but by the end it's like two-dimensional evil. Like, I'm going to be so sad when you die, but it'll bring me and your daughter together. Oh, hey, Cooper, let's go play with the ball. Like,
psychotic.
He's a little too, like, I am evil bad guy now.
I have a few thoughts, one of which is my good friend Paul, who listens to this podcast, so he may be listening. Hi, Paul. I love you. He was, like, a huge Star Wars fan, still is, and he was like, I didn't like What Lies Beneath because Harrison Ford plays a bad guy. And I was like, first of all, thanks for spoiling the movie. Second of all, what a weird reason to not like the movie because of the casting choice, you know? And of course, this was when we were in our early 20s or something. But yeah, I mean, obviously, and that is, you know, that is part of the point sometimes, is you want to cast the person that people don't suspect. You know, you don't cast Jack Nicholson in The Shining because everyone's like, well, of course he's going to murder everyone. The other thing I really like is the sort of up until he gets to that turning point that you're talking about, Michael. It's the sort of, I'm going to admit just enough.
Yeah.
To sort, you know, and that's like such a classic gaslighty type trick, yeah. but I think it actually works pretty well here. There's that like that oneer where he walks down the first time he's admitting things and the camera kind of follows him and makes like this other cool shot. But he's constantly going, okay, yes, I lied to you about this one little thing. I'm sorry. But I, you know, that was it. Right. And then 5 minutes later, but wait, what about this? Yeah, I mean, the reason I didn't tell you about that thing, and then as you're talking about Michael, then it turns into like, I am the killer, you know? And by that point, I didn't care, whatever.
Yeah, so I enjoy it.
Yeah.
Well, the movie does a really good job of, you know, again, with this is a tribute to the POV and keeping us with her and in her head, is that his reactions are often really unpredictable, and there's enough good and appropriate ones to counteract the ones that are off-putting and surprising. So mm-hmm. when we first meet his character, he's like, you know, kissing her and he's like, you know, I love you so much. And she's like, no, our daughter's awake. And he's like, we'll be quiet. And like, you know, they clearly are like still have really strong, like there's like a lot of passion and romance in their marriage. And, you know, we get that sort of back and forth where he's, after they take Caitlin to college, he like, you know, leads her off down the hall and puts an arm around her. He's really sweet with her and all of this stuff. And then there are those moments where he is like, why are you trying to ruin my work? Like, why are you, you know, making this about you and like inventing this ghost thing that's happening? And, you know, he's centering it all on himself and his work. And that's a moment in the movie where I'm like, I don't like you. And there's a, you know, we're so with her that we want nothing but sympathy and understanding and support. And it flips back and forth where he does give understanding, sympathy, support time and time again. And then also there are these moments where she goes to him and he is so cold and so awful to her that we see the, you know, the bumps in their marriage and the like simmering resentments in their marriage. And so in that sense, as like a domestic sort of drama or like a portrait of a relationship, it's actually really well done. Mm-hmm. And it keeps us guessing about whether or not he is the bad guy, right? So like you're pointing out that moment of like, yes, I believe you, you know, and they burn the hair of the ghost.
Because he read about exorcism and like took notes on a notepad.
There's a lot of odd like book things. Oh, I love his mm-hmm. notes. He's like,
like underlining
fire,
it.
Yeah. Destroy with fire. So great. But yeah, it is just like, you have to keep us guessing. You can't tip your hand too early, which means you have to sell us on he is a loving husband. There's a reason why she's still here. So right. Yeah. And it's in the performance, but it's in the writing of the character too.
And I do think, yeah, their performances and their relationship on screen is getting at another domestic psychological thing, yep. which is, do you really know your partner?
Exactly.
And you know, are they actually the person you think they are? And I do love when he is being just super villain at the end. Just all you can see is Michelle Pfeiffer's eyes just above mm-hmm. the water, and just the way she's looking at him. I think it is a great, you know, domestic thriller moment of, oh God, you are a sociopath, actually. Yeah. Like, it's not just that you like screwed up and did something bad once and you've been trying to cover it up. You're actually a sociopath. And I didn't realize that this whole time. And now I'm going to die. and that is, you know, even if it is cheesy, I like that moment. And I like that payoff. It's like the ultimate, if you're going to take a, you know, a premise and take it all the way, it's like, it's not just that you don't know your husband and didn't know about his affair. He's actually a sociopath and he's like really bad.
Yeah.
This episode is brought to you by Mubi, a curated streaming service showing exceptional films from around the globe. Every day, Mubi premieres a new film, from brand new work by emerging filmmakers to modern masterpieces from today's greatest icons. There is always something new to discover. With Mubi, each and every film is hand-selected. It's like your own personal film festival, streaming anytime, anywhere. To try Mubi free for 30 days, simply click on the link in the show notes, or if you're watching on YouTube, click the pop-up in the top right of the screen, or simply head to mubi.com/beyondthescreenplay. That's mubi.com/beyondthescreenplay for a whole month of great cinema for free. Thanks to MUBI for sponsoring Beyond the Screenplay. Yeah, well, and so we're here at the bathtub.
I was going to say, is it time?
Yeah, well, and so I was obsessed with the bathtub scene, and like I did with Psycho, would watch the bathtub scene like frame by frame and look at how, you know, there's the shot where he comes and puts her into the bathtub is shot from so high above that obviously it was on a set, but young Michael was like still figuring out that that was a thing that they did of like, oh, that must have been somewhere where they could get a crane high. So like they must have built a set. They don't just shoot things in real places, like all that stuff. And there's just so many little moments in that scene as far as how it's shot where, you know, there's a, when Harrison Ford is kind of like saying goodbye and has that moment of like, oh, I'm so sad. Like, look at you. I'm going to lean in and kiss you. The shot starts from Michelle Pfeiffer's POV, and he's basically looking at the camera, and the camera's kind of in the bathtub, and then he leans forward, and the camera somehow slides out of the way to then reveal her so that he can kiss her. It's like, it's a small thing that doesn't draw any attention to itself, but it's the kind of shot that's really difficult to pull off, and he didn't have to do it that way, but it's again putting us in her perspective. There's shots where it's like shot from below the bathtub because it's a clear bath. Like there's all these little things that don't take you out of it, but are just done in this extra little kind of unnecessarily complicated way that make that sequence really fun. I will say revisiting it, it wasn't as tense as I remembered it to be, but I still really enjoyed the ride that it takes you on. So,
I mean, I'll say revisiting it, I was impressed by how well it held up for me. Just, I think it does, it pushes that situation as far as you want to go before, you know, you need to like resolve it. And I think just the pacing and the different stages of what goes down, it doesn't overstay its welcome, but it does push you to that place of, oh God, I think she's screwed, you know, like a couple different times in a couple different ways. And so I think it's just a really, I think it's still worth studying as just a good example of like, you want to do like a shower scene, an equivalent kind of stressful domestic, I'm going to die situation. This scene, I think, has enough twists and turns and stages to it, but doesn't overstay its welcome and is completely believable as well. Like the way she gets out of it is believable and doesn't break the rules of the story to kind of cheat her situation to be resolved.
Yeah, I didn't remember it existed. So it wasn't about like, oh, is the scene going to be as good as I remember? It was just like, oh, okay, I don't even remember the scene exists. So it was a lot of fun. And I think that, yeah, there is something to be said about the simplicity, at least the initial premise of the scene, the simplicity of like a character really needs to achieve a goal and they can't because of some obstacle. You know, I mean, this is obviously just like Screenwriting 101, right? But just like a character who can barely move or has to crawl to like hit, do a thing or whatever. And then not only are they trying to do it and they can't do it, but there is a ticking clock about if they don't do it within this amount of time. You know, again, when I say it like that, it feels like the most obvious stuff, but this scene is like a really good example of how you do that in a way that really builds that tension and then really, you know, just makes you totally immersed on what's happening.
And the sequence itself has like these mini reversals in it as well, where it's, you're pointing out, Alex, that it's like, it doesn't just continually get worse. There are these moments where it gets better for her, where you think she's going to get out of it, or like that the key, like it's on the way to being resolved. And then something else takes it two steps back. Right. And so, you know, the moment that's actually one of the scariest to me is not the cheap scare where he puts her head back and it's the dead ghost face woman.
That is kind of a great moment though, because you do have like
moment.
The ghost is also like an actor here. Like it's not just the two of them versus each other. The ghost is also kind of influencing things.
Is present. And I want to get back to that, but there is that moment where then he falls, he hits his head, and we've got the bloody handprint on the side of the thing. And just, again, with perspective and POV, because she can't see where he is, we can't see where he is.
Right.
And it creates that unknown factor of like the danger is still here, presumably. So like, even if she gets the water turned off or even if she gets the plug pulled out, that's not immediately like she's going to be saved. And so it's a really interesting twist in the middle of the scene that kind of complicates the whole goal of it, which is really smart and cool.
Right. Right. You're talking about when she's finally like, not going to drown, and then looks over to like check on him and he's gone.
That is
a very scary moment, because like you're saying, the danger is still here somewhere and I don't know where, and now I'm just like, things just got worse.
Mirror shard is my only hope.
Well, but the other thing about this, the whole bathtub sequence, is that the context around it is what makes it even more tense, because it's interesting, in the shower scene in Psycho, we have no reason to suspect that the bathroom is dangerous. Right. So it's just pure shock factor. It's not suspense, right? It's not that, it's horror, but it's not the creeping suspense thrillery thing, because there's no context around it that tells us we should be scared until we see the door open in the, you know, upper left part of the frame in Psycho. Right. And so the thing that makes What Lies Beneath really scary is that from the very first scene of the movie, which is in the bathroom.
Why is she gasping and like drowning in the bathtub at the beginning?
You were asleep? Like, have questions. But again, every single time we're in that bathroom, it is signaled to us that this is where the danger is. And so there's been, it's been built up to and built up to. We have that utterly horrifying jump scare earlier where we see the ghost in the bathtub, the reflection of the ghost in the bathtub right next to her. Honestly, for my money, it's the best scare in the movie. Like, it's a really, really good one. But yeah, there's context around that space that they're in that creates that sense of dread or unpredictability. And again, with the same sort of unbalance that you feel with Harrison Ford's character Norman, where you don't know what kind of reaction you're going to get from him, where it's like, it could be really bad, it could be loving and understanding. We have that same kind of relationship with the bathroom. Like, the movie does a really good job of like, sometimes the bathroom is fine, right? Like, sometimes they're in there and they're doing a seance and we think it's going to be scary and the dog is here. Sometimes she's just, there's actually a scene not that long before the climactic bathtub scene where she's just in the bathtub taking a bath and everything's fine, right? Like, the movie does a really good job of imbuing that location with menace, but not so consistently that we feel grounded or like we can really predict what's going to happen. And so it's just a really well-designed climactic sequence. Yeah, that we're off balance from. We have the dread, that undercurrent of dread. We're already prepped for it, but also we don't feel like we know what's going to happen.
Yeah. Yeah. It is great for all these reasons. And I think the thing that was holding it back for me a little bit this time was that it does all hinge on a medicine thing that makes you paralyzed for X amount of time. Like, just the rules. It's all being enabled by her temporary paralysis, around which we don't have any like precise rules.
Fair.
So it's like, yes, it's cool that she manages to just barely get out of it, but it's also like, the movie decided that around now is when she can pick up her foot.
I mean, in fairness, they gave us very precise rules in the science lab when they're like talking about the rat. Too precise for my money. They literally say, how long does it last? Oh, about 5 minutes. You know, they actually give a timeline. They say it works on all mammals. You're still awake, but you're paralyzed. So it's cheap because it's like designed exactly for the situation. So it doesn't feel, you know, earned. But I would argue the movie does give you exactly the parameters in advance.
Sure. That's fair.
Yeah.
Cool. Well, why don't we move into lessons and talk about what lessons we're going to take away from What Lies Beneath, is a sentence I just said. Brian, do you want to start us off?
Sure. I didn't get to mention, though, real quick, talking about things that this movie on purpose or accidentally stole from, there's also speaking of ghost stories, the movie Ghost from 10 years earlier, where Sam types onto a computer, Sam, capital letters, three letters. And then in this movie, M-E-F, M-E-F, M-E-F on the computer. I was like, wait, I've already seen this.
A solitaire game.
Yeah, exactly. I was reading through the original script a little bit, and like the Queen of Hearts in the solitaire game like talks and says, off with your head, you lost the game. And I didn't read enough to know if that like it turns into a horror thing, but I was like, oh God, does it? Because... We need to read this script. Like, let's do a whole other episode where we actually read the script.
Live reading.
Yeah. Oh, my God. Live reading.
Oh, it can be fun.
I play Cooper. But I was just thinking, like, I'm always fascinated in horror what scares me, because I feel like jump scares are the cheapest form of horror. They are effective. But there are sometimes, you know, if you build up to it too much, then it's not scary. If you don't build up to it at all, then it can be scary, but sometimes it catches you so off guard that you're not even scared, but you're like, oh, I wasn't even paying attention in that moment. It's the reason I love The Haunting of Hill House is because they find these ways where I'm just like, no, I know it was coming, and it still terrified me. But I think the thing I keep coming back to with this movie is uncertainty. And it's kind of like you were talking about, Michael, with you look down and he's not next to the tub. Where is he? Now I'm uneasy because I don't know the answer. And the other scenes I was thinking about are the neighbor through the fence, where it's not just a jump scare. It's like, okay, if you show me a close up of a fence and a hole in a fence, I know I'm going to see an eye there in a second, right? Like, I don't care if I've seen only three movies in my life. I know that that's going to happen. But then the next 2 minutes of that scene are just a face on the other side of the fence, and you don't know where it is and what's going on. And then it's kind of over here, and like, you're just always uneasy because you can't wrap your brain around what is actually happening there. And I think the one that got me the most was when she walks in the house and there's the stereo is just making, it's like playing early dubstep or something, right? Like,
it's so loud.
Yeah. It just makes this weird sound. And we get the second maybe where she looks over and she sees it, but we don't see it yet. So we just hear this crazy sound. There's a scene in Marathon Man where Dustin Hoffman looks off screen and screams, and he has like the most loud, and like 70s movies were mixed in this very loud way. Before you even see what he's looking at, it's so terrifying because you're like, oh my God, like what is happening here? The uncertainty factor I think is really interesting. So when a character sees something and you don't know what it is, and you're not, you can't, that like little moment of unease before you can wrap your head around it. But I think it's that thing where you have to find the right balance. So like if you see the monster too early, too often in a monster movie, you're like, well, now I'm not scared of it anymore. It's just there. And then some movies try to never show it to you at all. So it's all in your mind. And it's like, well, then now I'm disappointed because like, I don't know. You got to show me the thing. I think like Cloverfield did a good version where it's like you see it a couple times. You get kind of a close up at the end, but you couldn't actually draw it. You couldn't actually say what it is. So it's still sort of a mystery in your mind. And I just think it's like, it's something, I'm talking about horror obviously, but it's something where that works in any sort of aspect of storytelling. I think it's like, if you give too much information, even like Harrison Ford, like the admission of guilt, right? It's like, if you do it all at once, then we know, like we're not interested anymore. It's just like, okay. But if you don't do it at all, right? Like it just suddenly at the end of the movie, he like kills her. Then it's like, wait, what? Like you didn't set that up at all. It's in any sort of character with a backstory or a secret or anything, you kind of have to find that balance where if you don't do it at all, then the audience doesn't lean in. And if you do it too much, the audience doesn't lean in. So you kind of have to like little cat with a string, you know, just right. So I was thinking about it from a horror standpoint, but then I was like, I can actually extract this into just storytelling in general, where it's just sort of like that nice balance between too much and too little in terms of the reveal, I guess.
Yeah. I like the example that you gave of her at the fence in that crazy scene, where there's just the right balance, like you're talking about, of imperfect information where you can only see a little bit of her face at any time, but you know via the context and the sounds that you're hearing, her performance, that she's distressed, but not being able to like fully resolve the whole picture in your brain creates this unease that makes you off balance. And yeah, I think, yeah, that's a really good, I'm going to carry that metaphor with me moving forward. The scary, weird neighbor that is has a very strange relationship. And
I'm
so
unclear on what was actually happening over there.
Yeah.
Also, Miranda Otto. Yeah.
Yeah. Eowyn.
And Joe Morton from Terminator 2, Miles Dyson as the psychiatrist.
Yeah,
as
a psychologist. Yeah.
Have a fireball.
Yeah. Awesome. Cool. Trisha, what's your lesson?
Yeah, my lesson has to do, I'm going to return a little bit to the backstory and just how I really feel like there's a missed opportunity with it to create a mystery, like, I don't know, like a different sense of mystery at the beginning of the film. So, you know, they spend half of the movie building up this like red herring with the neighbors. And I think that it's fine. And I think that it's compelling enough. But part of me wonders if the first half of this movie were more about the accident or like her maybe recovering. So like, what if we, you know, came into the movie 6 months after the accident and she's still kind of healing, you know, maybe there's like some lingering effects, something physical that we can see on her body that we understand that she was like in an accident. She's still sort of healing and like, maybe that's the reason she stopped playing music, right? Like, so she was a cellist and her arm was broken in the accident and now she can't play anymore. Okay, great.
You just like did a huge thing for this script right here. And like, and he's like directly responsible for that because that's why she got in the car accident.
That's what I'm saying.
I feel like every time I watch it, I'm expecting that to be the case, but it's not the case.
It's not the case.
She stopped for other unrelated reasons.
So messy. Yeah. So her, you know, like she wants to pick her cello back up, but she's like kind of shaking out her arm. It doesn't work the way that it used to. She's really frustrated and sad about that. And then she's talking to her friend and like maybe she and her friend both have really incomplete information about what happened the night of the accident or like in the weeks leading up to it. And so there's something maybe not quite right about it to her. And she's like, you know, having the conversation that she and her friend have at the midpoint, like much earlier on, where she's like, you know, oh, I saw you like 2 days before. And what were we talking about? Well, oh, we mentioned this like thing that, you know, I was in this little town, Adamant, the weirdest name for a little town.
Oh my God.
Inanimate.
Inanimate. Like inanimate? My child brain. Yeah. Oh my God.
I never understood what she was saying.
But what if the whole red herring in the first act was not about the neighbors? What if it was about the accident and her poking into it? And then she uncovers something and thinks that she solved it, right? Like, oh, I was, you know, actually what I discovered was it must have been this like horrifying truth about, I don't know, something to do with the orchestra she was playing with or something else. Or, you know, that's what leads to the confession from her husband that he had had an affair. So what if she finds out about the affair halfway through? And then we think, oh, the creepiness is over. Maybe the ghost story is over. And maybe all of that was part of the psychological unease. And then the second half becomes like, no, the ghost is real, maybe that kind of thing. And so I just feel like, again, wanting to streamline both halves of what this is. And I do appreciate that the neighbors create, you know, sort of like that, the clones that we talked about, where it's like they have marital problems, just like we do, kind of a thing.
They have loud sex, just like we do.
But it just ends up going, the neighbors as clones thematically ends up going completely nowhere. Whereas I feel like if you could either tie the neighbors thematically more directly into what happens with her and Norman, or if you could make the mystery in the first half something more about the accident, again, help us put a timeline together of what happened last year with the accident. And then we kind of figure out, no, there's this whole other side of it that we think we solved it, but we didn't solve it. And it's way worse than we ever could have imagined. And make that sort of be the midpoint hinge and then go on from there into the second act. I just feel like it would be a lot neater. And the raw material is all here. It just gets really muddy the way that it's put together now. Not that it's not still very enjoyable, but.
The lesson is hire Trisha for your rewrite because, I want to see that movie.
or hire me to work with Clark Gregg. I feel like he'd be a fun person to work with.
Yeah, I could see that. We should have him on the podcast. Clark, if you're listening, hit us up. We'd love to have him on the podcast.
We love your movie. It inspired us, strangely.
It's really true. Awesome. Well, Alex, what's your lesson then?
I kind of talked about this earlier with Harrison Ford's character having these flashes of menace throughout the movie. It's part of almost what Brian was saying, where it's like you want some anticipation of the bad thing, but not too much. And I think there's some really key moments I picked up on this time where, you know, they can be read as just marital tensions or soft spots. Like she says, Norman, you're so sensitive. And the way he looks at her and says, I'll have to work on that, won't I? It's very much, there's something else there that's not just, oh, I'm sensitive right now. It's like, I have a darkness in me. And, you know, if you poke this part of me, it could get scary. Mm-hmm. And so I just really appreciate the effort, both in the writing and Harrison Ford's performance to both give us the, you know, yeah, like sexy dad husband. And like, you know, he's able to be like, you know, super horny husband in the first parts of the movie. But then he's also is able to be this kind of threatening, not always supportive, gaslighting her sort of figure. And so that when it does make that turn into like actual sociopath, we've had this trail of breadcrumbs the whole time. That's like, oh, wait a minute. There's red flags left and right here.
So many, yeah.
And once it adds up, you're like, oh, this kind of makes sense. Like it makes sense that he's been lying. He's been gaslighting her. Yeah.
It's something I mentioned with Matt Damon in The Departed, where it's like they're putting those red flags. And it's like, if you've seen the movie, you're like, oh, look at what a dick he is. But if you haven't, it's like, oh, maybe they're just setting up some conflict. They're setting up some flaws that he has to kind of resolve, you know, and it's those little things that could go either way until you know, obviously, where they're going.
Yeah. So yeah, I think it's actually, it's a more sophisticated character than I think I registered when I was younger, as far as the breadcrumbs that lead you all the way towards evil sociopath killer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I do feel like that is one of the like successes of this movie, is how they balance that part of it, for sure. My lesson is a directorial one, and we've talked about Wonners a lot on the podcast.
So many good Wonners.
There are so many good ones in this one, and they're the kind that don't annoy me, because sometimes I can get annoyed when the movie is like, stop everything, audience, look, we're doing a Wonner. Are you paying attention? Like, things that draw your attention too much can annoy me. And there are some of those in this, not you know, so ostentatious, but, you know, there's when she's just emptied the bathtub and then she kind of walks around
folding
the room.
Folding some clothes.
Right. Yeah. Da-da-da-da-da. And then I get around and I open the door and the bathtub's been filled again. And it's like steaming hot because that's one of the ghost's powers.
Instant bathtub refills.
Yeah.
Worst superhero ever.
It's like that and knocking pictures over is just what she spends her time doing.
Opening the front door.
Right. Yeah. Opening the front door. She's good at that. But there are also so many long takes in just conversation scenes and dialogue scenes between characters. Like when the friend comes over, it's a long take of her sitting next to Michelle Pfeiffer and they talk and it plays out over, you know, 60 seconds in this one shot. One of my favorite ones is the dinner scene where Michelle Pfeiffer and Harrison Ford go out and like, there's
the cross table talk.
Yeah. I looked that up in the script and it's literally that thing where there's two columns and they just have sets of dialogue. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So there's this overlapping dialogue. It's all being played in this one long take and it grounds the movie as much as I think this movie can be grounded. Mm-hmm. It makes it feel, you know, I think you can only do this with really great actors, but it feels real and authentic and you kind of buy in. It makes you lean in a little bit. It creates tension because you're not cutting. So I feel like it's doing all these things that are really useful in this story and in this genre. And it's also just like really nice to see multiple actors in a frame together. This is actually one of the weird insights that I've gotten from like doing lessons from the screenplay and editing the videos and all this stuff over like 5 years is like so many times, and Alex, you edited a lot of them and we've talked about this, but like so many times we're saying something on the script and I just want to be able to show both characters at once in a frame, but it's always just shot reverse shot. Like so many movies never actually show multiple characters on screen at the same time and let them have a scene. So I really appreciate that this movie goes for oneers even in these dialogue scenes, because it accomplishes so much. And I think it's what helps elevate the movie in many ways.
I really love the moment in that scene too, where Harrison Ford puts her on the spot.
The look she gives him.
Yeah, the look she gives him. It's really good, where he's like, I'm just going to air all of our dirty laundry about this ghost and like this thing that is really deep and really secret and just say it at dinner. It's like a really good moment.
It's such a real moment. You know, it's that like awful couple moment where
it's when your partner says something and you're just like, hang on.
Yeah.
Right.
Speaking of partners, I want to before we wrap up, my husband was walking in and out of this movie the other night and watching for parts of it. And I think he saw it back in like 2000, but had forgotten everything. And at one point he just blurted out, this is a sexist movie about a wife with nothing better to do than to lollygag around the house. I was like, I mean, I can't argue with that description.
A lot of, the tension, or like, there's a lot of like, women left at home with nothing to do, getting up into trouble. Like, that's a lot of the conflict coming in the first half anyway.
But if it were better, established that she was kind of forced into that by the backstory, where it's like he derailed her career advertently or inadvertently to like advance his own career, which is kind of how I read it, right? It's part of the gaslighting thing. So,
Yeah,
and I think it is valid to tell a story about. I mean, there are plenty of people who just are at home all day and feel like they're going crazy. That is an American thing. That is the suburbs. You know, we've been exploring that in a lot of our films, and so I think it's a real phenomenon that is worth exploring. But I thought it was just hilarious. He's like, "What is she doing? She's just walking around the house again."
Yeah.
It's also why it feels like a very, 2000s movie of American Beauty on either side. I'm just like, suburbia, it's so
what
hard.
A nightmare, yeah.
Right, yeah. Yeah. Beautiful, expansive house for two people on a lake. Yeah.
Right.
Another example of how dangerous roses are. The cut she gets from that rose bush, I'm sorry, is so deep and intense.
It's like on her wrist and everything. Yeah,
right. And she gets cut, like you were saying, so many times on so many things. She just walks around getting cut on things, and like it usually leads to a clue. But so is the ghost making. I don't just
the ghost has many ways.
The ghost rules her. Yeah. Awesome. What have you guys been watching, Brian? What have you been watching?
I finally, after much procrastinating, caught up on the second season of Atlanta, which is the show created by Donald Glover, which stars Donald Glover, Brian Tyree Henry, you may know from Beale Street and the upcoming Eternals movie, Lakeith Stanfield, who you know from everything lately, and Zazie Beetz, who is awesome. They've all just had these great careers since the show took off. The story behind this show is that Donald Glover sold it as the Black Entourage because his character, Earn, is managing his cousin, who is a rapper who goes by Paperboy and has had some success, is recognized in town. And then once the show got picked up, he's like, yeah, I'm just going to do whatever I want. So the show is you are, generally speaking, you are following these characters in a linear story that plays out over the course of a season. But so many of the episodes are just a standalone idea that sometimes only focuses on one character, where they're the only character in the episode, or the other characters are just in one little side scene or something. And it's just what if this character got lost in the woods while having an identity crisis? And that's the episode, right? What if Lakeith Stanfield goes to a mansion to get a piano and he has to deal with this crazy, eccentric, white question mark person who lives there, who is actually Donald Glover in the most bizarre makeup ever? Look up Google Teddy Perkins if you want to know what I'm talking about. It is unbelievable. It's a total trip. It's you never know what you're going to get from episode to episode, but it's just smart. It's entertaining. I'm watching the look at everyone's faces as they're Googling Teddy Perkins. it's been 3 years since a season, but we are finally getting season three, I think early next year. So it is a good time to check out the show or catch up if you haven't. And yeah, it's just, it's such a weird show because it's not one of those shows where you can be like, oh, I know what I'm in for when I'm watching the next episode. It's like, I have no idea what I'm in for, but I'm excited.
Nice.
Yeah.
Yeah. I need to go back and watch it again. I think I went into it expecting too much of a normal show.
Right.
And now that I know more of what it is, I think I would like it a lot more. Trisha, what have you been watching?
Yep. So I caught a movie. I caught an indie movie from 2010 called Please Give, which is written and directed by Nicole Holofcener. And I really, really liked it. It's got Oliver Platt and a whole lot of other people. Let me like pull up the list. Yeah, so it's one of our favorites ever, Rebecca Hall, Catherine Keener, Elise Ivey, who's really great in it. Amanda Peet is really great in it. Paul Sparks, who I really like in like a small role. Lois Smith, who's one of the greatest ever. It's just a really great little comedy. And, you know, for whatever reason, it resonated with me. It's sort of just like an indie movie from around that time that I feel like a lot of those movies are, which is just like, here are people who are doing okay, mostly, and they also have some problems. And like that.
Right.
That's what all of those movies are. And that's exactly what this is. You know, Catherine Keener's married to Oliver Platt, and they have a teenage daughter, and they're like furniture dealers in Manhattan, and they buy furniture from the estates of dead people. And they also own the apartment that's next door to theirs. They bought it out from under their elderly neighbor with the idea that once she dies, they're gonna like bump out and like expand their apartment into what is gonna be, you know, what was her apartment. So they already own it. They've already bought it from her. So they're just transparently waiting for her to die. And Rebecca Hall plays her granddaughter. And anyway, it is just like, it's an example of like one of those comedies that's sort of poignant, or I guess like dramedy is sort of more of an accurate a genre description for it. But for whatever reason, I don't know, I just really liked it. Catherine Keener is really great in it, and as she is in everything all the time. And she just feels really sad about a lot of things. Like she sort of is filled with loathing for herself, for waiting for this elderly woman to die, for dealing furniture at exorbitantly high prices in Manhattan. And no one else around her feels guilty about her existence, but she feels very guilty about it. And, I don't know. It's just like a poignant little dramedy, and I really enjoyed it. So definitely recommend Please Give from 2010.
I said, yeah, I was looking it up, and Nicole Holofcener, I was like, oh, why do I know that name? And yeah, Enough Said.
Oh,
and
yeah, she's
Friends
wonderful.
With Money. And then
Friends
she,
with Money, which I really like.
She co-wrote The Last Duel with Ben and Matt. So she's current.
Which I haven't seen yet. So yeah.
It's so good.
Okay. is that what you're watching, Alex?
That was his last week.
That was last week.
Oh, yeah. That's right.
Trisha doesn't listen.
Wow.
Awesome. Cool. Well, Alex, what is your watching this week?
I is watching the new season of Succession, which is just better than ever. My God, like the writers on this show are brilliant. The whole cast is brilliant. It's some of the most sharp, witty, like perfect satire of like this elite wealthy elite family, you know, media mogul played by Brian Cox and all of his like awful kids. It's just the most, if you want to just watch like a single episode of television that just feels so tight and so well written from start to finish, watch the first episode of this season three. I was just blown away. I'm like, wow, this show is up there and one of the best. This is the best writing I'm seeing on TV right now. So wow. I can't recommend Succession enough. You know, there's some ups and downs in seasons one and two. I wasn't always this thrilled with it, but season three so far has gotten off to an amazing start. And it's just deliciously, wonderfully fun. So nice. Check it out.
Nice. Awesome. Yeah, I've been meaning to. Maybe now that there's a third season, I'll do a big binge catch up and follow the third season. Awesome. I have been watching Foundation, the Apple TV Plus series, and so have all of you. We are now 8 episodes in to our what we're watching of Foundation, Apple TV Plus series based on the books by Isaac Asimov. It has been a very interesting ride. There's only 2 episodes left. We're going to see how it ends. But if you want to go on this crazy journey with us, there are some, I feel like we've had fun talking about the do's and don'ts and the challenges that have come with adapting this material. Some notes that I've made that I think are highlights are like, why doesn't Lee Pace have a belly button? They still say hard pass in thousands of years, as well as shotgun. I do not want to see Apple TV sex scenes. Very pretty episode. Why would their typeface be like this? And a character yelling, I hate the math. So
it's a really valid note about the typeface, though.
It's such a hard typeface. It's been a really crazy ride. We're almost at the end. So if you are watching or care to watch and catch up, we have episodes for each episode of the series over on our Patreon for the $5 and up tier. So that's what I've been watching, and we're almost there.
God bless us.
God bless us. And this has been our conversation about what lies beneath. We did it, guys.
Wow.
I never thought we'd be here.
It's a very long time coming.
Yes. I guess we can stop talking about it now.
Never.
We want to say a big thank you, as always, to the patrons that make this show possible. Thank you to our producer, Vince Major. I'm Michael Tucker, and I've been joined today by Trisha Rand, Brian Bittner, and Alex Calleros. All of our Twitter handles are in the show notes. Send us a tweet and say how much you love What Lies Beneath, and we will see you in the next episode.
Bye, everybody.
Bye-bye.
Bye.